Wonderful. Well, we are all privileged to have Jean-François Nouvel with us today to share a bit more about his journey on this Thanksgiving weekend. He's a man that's hard to describe, but let me share a few pieces of background from my understanding. To me, the most inspiring part of Jean-François's journey is his personal authenticity. We spent a few days together earlier this year, and this man was running barefoot, literally barefoot, all around New York City. And he would go in and meet with these titans of industry and share with them how they could live a joyous existence. And I was very intrigued how this person could do both sides of the coin so beautifully. And to provide a bit of the concrete background on him, for those that don't know, Jean-François was a co-founder of AOL France. He now lives without even a bank account. It's that juxtaposition. On one side, he's been to jail on multiple occasions, but he's also given multiple TED Talks, including one yesterday. He's got multiple black belts. And then on the other side, he's teaching me some martial arts and tells people that he doesn't believe in competition. So this kind of dissonance in so many ways seems to be an ongoing theme, and it's quite difficult to describe. So I'm glad we have him to share more. Jean-François, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure, Birger. You know that.
Well, just to level set for the audience, can you share a little bit more in your own words about what you're most passionate about nowadays and what you're doing about it?
Thank you, Birger. First, thank you for the way you share about me. I never heard that. And that's quite an experience to hear your words. I feel very blessed to be seen and understood like that. Being seen is such a blessing when others see you. And so thank you very much. I think my passion today is just being. There's nothing else. Being. And being means that I always try to connect to my own essence, to what is alive in me, what kind of calls I may feel in the present moment, what is the next step, without making any plans. Just be in joy and gratitude. And express that through the forms of art that I like. So it can be music, it can be martial arts, it can be talk with people, it can be write about collective intelligence or the economy, which are my passion, or do research and development. I mean, there are many ways I feel passionate about life. I mean, many ways to express that. But beyond these different forms of expression, it's always the choice of the authentic being as far as I can go there. And when I go there, when I seat in the center of my being, then there's no need for values, for instance. There's no need for morals. You've heard me, Birju, say I have no values or I'm useless. Like I'm not trying to be a function of something, just be. And the consequence is that you come up with values, but you don't need them as an external kind of container. The being creates the values, and the values don't need to contain anything. So I don't feel I have any duty. I don't feel I have any morals. I don't feel I have any values, or if they appear as such, it might be because they are consequences of the joy of being. And my experience is that it just takes me where I need to be, and it creates the most symbiotic relationship with the world. So I guess that's it. That's what I could say about my passion. I think it also creates power. Now in French we have two words for that, and unfortunately I don't see those two words in English. In French we have two words for power. One is la puissance, and another one is le pouvoir. And la puissance, this first way to say power, is this kind of natural power or cosmic power that is given to you when you just let your being, the boss in you. And the pouvoir is this other kind of power, which is more about political power or financial power, power onto people. And I really noticed that the more you go into the being and the more you get into this first form of power, that just gives you the creative power, the freedom power, power of freedom. And therefore, you don't need anything else. As the second form of power, you don't need to, you know, have a position somewhere or to look like something or to have some kind of name or possess something. You really don't need that because this kind of temporal power becomes completely useless and meaningless and so small compared to what is given to you in the other way. So I wanted to share that about the being also where it takes me, and I'm so happy about that. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing that perspective. I think you just shared so much right off that opening piece. I'd love to dive into pieces of that. And one of the phrases that I heard you share was you were deeply pulled towards collective intelligence. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? What is it? When have you used it?
Collective intelligence connects to two things. First, collective intelligence is a property of social living. When you have a colony of ants, an ant colony, or a school of fish, or a startup, or a big company, or a sports team, or a jazz band, or a forest, or 30,000 billion cells in your body, you have collective intelligence. That means groups, small or large, of individuals inside the same species or between different species who collaborate together. And they don't just collaborate. It means that they really build, they act as a whole entity, as something that has its own kind of consciousness, its own kind of behavior, its own kind of character. And this is what collective intelligence is about. So it is a property that we can observe everywhere around us, and it has become a research field that has the same name. So when we say, I do research in collective intelligence, that means we study this this property, and I do have a passion for that, yes.
So how can one bring an understanding of the collective intelligence into the world for the listeners that are on today?
I guess first it's really about observing. You want to tap into your own experience. And I guess the experience we all have at some point in our lives is this moment when we are part of a group. It might be like this group right now, or a fantastic sports team, or at work, when you feel that, okay, wow, there is a whole here. There's a sense of wholeness and a whole, something that really appears as an entity by itself. And I feel that I am connected to that entity. I feed it, and it feeds me in return. There's a back and forth exchange, very nourishing exchange in both ways. And you do have the sense of belonging to that, but that collective entity. And at the same time, you nourish that. And it really creates a sense of fulfillment and joy and power as well, because you can really express who you are, and your being is really feeding this whole thing. So this is what I could say about the kind of ultimate sense of collective intelligence. And as a discipline, of course, you observe what are the different forms of collective intelligence around us. That's a very important part. So I can name the big, you know, four of them, the big categories, just to give you a quick understanding. One is what we can call the swarm collective intelligence. Swarm is when you have big numbers, you know, like ant colonies or schools of fish. And it can also apply to human species. For instance, when you have a street contest, or, you know, the New York Marathon, for instance, or everyday traffic, for instance, you have people in their cars, and you may feel very restricted in your freedom when you are, you know, stuck into traffic. But collectively, this kind of collective intelligence is able to fill in and fill out a whole city, like New York or Los Angeles, And so it can accomplish very incredible things at a collective level. Then you have another form of collective intelligence, which is the one that where we really come from that. That's really our kind of collective intelligence as a human species, which we call the original collective intelligence. It's the small group, the small team, the family, the tribe, the jazz band, the task force, the squad in the army, you know, so a small number of people. And it pretty much has the property that I described earlier, when you really feel you can really see the whole, the emerging whole, and you can really accomplish your tasks, your movements, your actions, because you are connected to this whole. That's why we have, you know, meeting rooms in large companies, for instance, because we want to reconnect to this kind of collective intelligence, the original collective intelligence. But it works only with small numbers. You cannot be many, many players there, and you have to be in proximity, because you have to perceive everyone. So when it comes to large number, then we go into the third kind of collective intelligence, which is called pyramidal, like a pyramid. Pyramidal collective intelligence, which works with, you know, command and control, top-down structures, centralized powers, scarce currency. That means, you know, if you want centralized powers, you need some kind of currency to have some scarcity built in, so that it will concentrate in the hands of the few, and you will have natural hierarchies that will emerge. So it all goes along together, hand in hand, centralized powers, pyramidal collective intelligence, and scarce currency systems. And then the fourth kind of collective intelligence, we call it holomidal collective intelligence, like holistic, holos, the whole. Holomidal means that at a large scale, through internet, it's a very recent one, very recent form of collective intelligence. You see, you know, clouds, networks of people that are connected together, and it mostly works bottom-up rather than top-down. And this new form of collective intelligence really restores the individual choice connected to many, many, many diversity all around you, lots of complexity there, but it requires the internet to operate. And it seems that it's much more powerful than pyramidal collective intelligence. And it is still seeking its new forms of economy and new forms of currency systems, because that kind of collective intelligence cannot operate inside a scarcity model or inside a scarce currency system. So that's, you know, that's kind of very, very quick overview of how we can look at the world through the lenses of collective intelligence, and understanding just this fundamental basics on collective intelligence really is really helpful for people to understand where they play and how they can play, depending on the situations or the kind of collective intelligence they belong to. Does it help?
I think very helpful, and at the same time, I know that you're just scratching the surface of the depth here on all of these four different categories. And just to push a little bit further, if you could share a little bit of the differences between the pyramidal structure that you mentioned and the holomidal. As a listener, it sounds to me like the conventional paradigm is pyramidal today, and there are some ramifications of that that you alluded to. If you could expand on that, and also expand on the ramifications of moving to a holomidal structure.
I think the conventional forms are both pyramidal and original. Look now, we are not, you know, a huge group of people. Although we're remotely connected, but we are a small team, and in many places, you know, including in the pyramidal world, we find ourselves, you know, sitting in meeting rooms, for instance, and we come back into original collective intelligence. So original collective intelligence and pyramidal collective intelligence are the two prevailing forms of collective intelligence that we're familiar with. Original because it comes from, you know, so far away. Our species has evolved through that. And pyramidal because it was the evolutionary response to the limitations of original that humanity found by building, you know, these social pyramids and command and control structures. So yes, pyramidal is still prevailing everywhere in the world, when we have medium-sized or big-sized companies, corporations, administrations, governments, states, churches, you know, or religious orders, and so on. Now, I would say the difference between pyramidal and holomidal is connected to the limitations, because you have evolution, you have new forms of life that emerge when the previous form is really hitting a wall. And that's what every one of us experiences today. The wall that pyramidal collective intelligence is hitting is mostly connected to complexity and centralization of power and centralization of resources and ecology, because there's so much of this kind of pyramidal collective intelligence that it has a very, very strong impact on the ecosystems and our structure. Let me give a few examples, and I don't want to be too long there, because it's quite a rich and complex topic. For instance, pyramidal collective intelligence works with chains of command, and so it means, you know, these top-down structures, and someone is giving an order at the top, and then everyone executes the order, and it breaks down into, you know, different tasks and labor division. That's how it works fundamentally. In order to make this work, you need to have human beings that become very, very, very predictable. That means they are going to accomplish such and such task regardless how their being is. Now, if you look at a, you know, 5 years old child, the 5 years old child does what he is and is what he does or she does. That means there is no gap, no difference between being and doing. Real time, every being is mirroring the doing, and doing is mirroring the being. 20 years later, you see this same human being after school, after years and years of long, intensive training. And this person becomes capable of doing things that have nothing to do with the inner being. And in many cases, the inner being has been buried, you know, under lots of loads of cultural stuff, or, you know, duty, or morals, or just habits or belief systems or things like that. And it becomes even unconscious. So that means the society is built on pyramidal collective intelligence, are making very, very agile people in the doing, extremely performant people in the doing. But at the same time, they're mostly ignorant about the being. People don't know themselves. And this is a necessity for pyramidal collective intelligence to work, to be operational. But of course, the counterpart of that is when you have entire societies where people are so good at doing and so bad at being, well, we know what is the price to pay. It might be okay at a small scale, but when it's at the planetary scale, and where we need to go into holistic thinking and empathy and generosity, then you need a little bit of being here. And this is why, you know, I can't go any further. And there's so much more to say, you know, like why it is concentrating power, and then it's concentrating resources, and it's concentrating decision-making processes, and so it cannot address complexity, and it cannot really adapt to complexity. So basically, pyramidal collective intelligence is hitting a wall. At the same time, the end of something is providing the fundamental bricks for what is next. And what is next is, you know, you take more and more conscious people, people who decided, no, I don't want to just, you know, separate myself anymore. I do want to do who I am, and I want to be what I do. So I'm not going to play this game anymore. And then you add to that networked computers and internet, you put all this in a bottle and you shake it, and you have, you know, holomidal collective intelligence emerging everywhere. That means people who really detour the use of the usage of computers and networks that were made for pyramidal collective intelligence in the first place, but they use it in a very different way. And now you have social media, and you have, you know, meetings like us today, gathering, and this is kind of new, and people doing incredible things that pyramidal collective intelligence cannot even understand or achieve. So that's a little bit of a difference.
So you're mentioning
does that answer?
This is very helpful. I think it dives into the specifics of what you're doing about it, I think, pretty interestingly, where you're sharing that look, there's people out there that want to move to new forms of collective thinking, and here we have this technology in the form of the internet or the networked computing that can provide the support. I heard you mention this term transitioning or the transitioners. Can you share more about what you're doing leveraging technology to try to help, you know, support this new movement?
Sure. There are many ways to talk about it. One of the main of the core work of using technology to leverage our power is through designing new currency systems. That means really free ourselves from the limitations of conventional money. Because conventional money is a tool for pyramidal collective intelligence, conventional money has built-in scarcity dynamics in it. And it's easy to understand, you know, if you've played the Monopoly game when you were a kid, it is based exactly on this principle. You know, you have a bank and you start the game with a few players and everyone is equal. We have the same amount of money. And then we start to play a little bit, make decisions, roll the dices. And then you see that the more you have money and the more you can invest, and the more you invest, the more you have money, the more you have money, the more you can invest, and so on. And on the opposite side, the less you have money, the more you have to pay to others because you can't invest yourself. So the less money you have, and the less you have, and so on. And so you start to see exponential curves. You know, one goes into concentration of money that will end up in the end of one player called the winner, and then everyone else is losing. Except that it's in the theory of game, in the game theory, this is called a collective death. Because if you have all the money yourself, but everyone is dead around you, then you can't play anymore. You're as dead as they can be. Okay? And by the way, this is why Monopoly game was designed in the first place by a Quaker, a peaceful, nonviolent woman who wanted to teach through playing, through gamification, to people how they were fooled by the economic system. And it's interesting to notice that this same game was taken over by more conventional or less evolved form of consciousness saying, well, the guy who has it all is the winner without having any systemic understanding of the whole thing. So I'm saying that because designing tools that are not against money but are better than money, that means that don't create scarcity or concentration of power, but that just provide you with the right information system so that you can do what is right for you. What is the next right action? And you're not going to be limited because of a lack of currency. Designing this kind of tool is a passion, and I'm really committed to that.
Cool. Very interesting, Jean-Francois. Can you share an example with us of a form of transaction that is better than money?
Sure. Well, first, I think we can check our language here. For instance, we say transaction, and there's a trap in the language itself. It is called an ontological trap. That means the way we describe reality, because I think we want to talk about more about wealth in the true sense, and that can include material things, you know, potatoes and food, but also quality of life, quality of water, things you can measure or kind of wealth you can express. But when we say a transaction, then we kind of shrink down or reduce our understanding of economy as things that go from one place to another. That means the material world. If I do a transaction, that means, you know, something goes from my hand to your hands and something goes from your hands to my hands. Something is moving. And this is not wrong by itself, but it's not sufficient. So first, maybe we want to say, or we want to transform the question and say, hey, do you want to talk about an experience between two people? And in that experience, and this is exactly what I was sharing yesterday at the TED Talk, in that experience, there might be a transaction. For instance, you're getting my potatoes from my garden, and you're giving me some kind of currency back, and that's the transactional part. But also, maybe you think, wow, these potatoes are so good. And I'm going to tell you, JF, that your potatoes are delicious. And that will be the traditional form to say, they're good. It's a verbal way to say it. But today, why we also don't say it inside a network, you know, through a machine and write it down so that other people that might be far away in the other side of the world know that JF makes delicious potatoes and that JF is a nice guy, for instance, if it's the case, okay? So what you would say in verbal form, as we have been raised to do so in a village, for instance, why can't we also write it down into information systems? Of course, it takes a little bit of education because we have not been raised to do this way. But the evolution is, why don't we write our experiences about one another that can include transactions, but also gratitude, thanks, or that can express the measure of some kinds of wealth? For instance, what is the objective measure of the quality of water that we drink? Or what is the objective measure of the biodiversity around us? Or inside a company, what is the objective measure of the number of hours that people are giving to one another for mutual training, peer-to-peer training? Or what is the objective measure inside a company of turnover, for instance? Or what is the measure that we can make of how people send thank yous or smileys or thumbs up or claps to one another? And this is called acknowledgeable wealth, you know, the wealth that we use to acknowledge each other. So what I'm saying here is that the economy cannot be reduced just to transaction, which is the conventional thinking. You know, it's kind of describing a flat world of just transactions and just leaving aside in the unconscious part all the other forms of wealth that are so natural that need to flow at the same time. So we want to move into a collective consciousness and a collective writing and a collective memory of these all these forms of wealth. And this is where I think we can evolve. Does that speak to your question?
I think it does. And much like so many of your pearls of wisdom, it opens up more questions.
I know, yes. That's one of the issues.
Well, it's so beautiful. You mentioned, you know, this deep concept to me of saying we are hampered or we are limited by the choice of grammar and words or ontological structures that we choose to use. And it certainly applies as it relates to monetary systems. So are there other areas where you see that the words we're using are limiting us?
Oh, yes. I could speak for hours, if not days, about that. Yes, our language, we can have what we call ontological jails. Ontological jails. That means the way our reality is described by our language can just keep us trapped into jails. I mean, we don't see things, or because we don't name them, or we have no words, or we can also just map reality in a very wrong way. I can take a few examples. For instance, if I say something like, "Hey, Birju, what you said 5 minutes ago was really stupid," okay, or was very smart. Doesn't matter what the way we say it. But when I say, okay, it was this or it was that, it says that it has an intrinsic quality that has nothing to do with me. It doesn't acknowledge that I am building some kind of response inside myself, some emotion or some thoughts that belong to me and I'm fully responsible for. So conventional language, when we say, oh, this is like this, or it is like that, or it is this, or it is that, well, then you are not invited to make a clear distinction between what is the external stimulus that you have, the signal that comes to you, that comes to you, and what is that you're building inside yourself as an emotional or mental kind of response. You don't make this distinction, and conventional language does not help you with that. Another example is what I call thingification. You know, when you thingify, you transform the world into things. Like when I say, hey, I am eating meat, okay? Well, meat, when I say that, it just becomes a thing. It does not provide me with the whole understanding of all, you know, life that was there before, and what happened, you know, before some piece of meat, that thing came into my plate. It just says meat. So it creates a disconnection between myself and reality. I just simplified something. I thingified something in the world, and so I'm separating myself from the world. A last example is when we say, oh, the homeless, or the French, or the Japanese, or, you know, the this or that, when you reduce someone to a unique quality, and that person is that thing, you know, the homeless, for instance. So this man or this woman in the street, this human being, is homeless. That's all it is. That's all there is. And you start to forget that, you know, it's so many other things. There are so many other dimensions there. So this oversimplification is also keeping us trapped into a way to describe the world that doesn't match reality, because reality is that, you know, this person has much more qualities than being homeless. So you see, I could go on and on and on. This is a fascinating, you know, topic there.
Very interesting. I think I have to watch the words that I use and the questions that I'm asking.
Yeah, be careful.
Well, if I may switch.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to switch gears a little bit. So if you have a thought, please do share.
Just something that I maybe invite you to look at if you want to pursue this this quest is you can go to Wikipedia and look at E prime, that refers to English prime, and this is how you can learn to speak English without using the verb to be, which I've been using all the time because I'm not trained. I'm training myself to use to speak in French and write in French and write in English without the verb to be. And then I can see the huge steps that I'm making or that I make in describing reality or connecting to reality. So it's a whole topic. Of course, I'm not trained enough right now to speak English without the verb to be, which I use all the time, but I really expect that I'll make some progress in the future. But I just wanted to mention that because if you want to explore that, there's a very rich path to explore.
Thank you for sharing. And I'll definitely kind of leave it open in the post formal part of this discussion if others want to dive deeper into that topic area. But I did want to switch gears really quickly, Jean-François, to talk about your life specifically. You know, you say on your website that you live your life, quote unquote, in the offering, as a tree would offer its fruits. And you know, I'd love to get a deeper definition of what that means. And then two, you know, to me, the follow-on question is why? You know, we live in a world where if somebody wants to give, we set up an enterprise to share, we build a social business, we talk about creating jobs for many people and scaling out the idea to impact many lives. And you've chosen what I believe is a different path. So I'd love if you could share the rationale behind it.
How can we fundamentally evolve if we still play with the same kind of DNA? I think one of the examples I shared just before, if we play with the same words or the same way to describe reality, then we just may reproduce this reality. I can even say that I disagree with the way the world is, but when I just, you know, speak or describe why I disagree with the world, and then I perpetuate this world I disagree with because I'm using the same structure. So, for instance, in social activism or, you know, all the social entrepreneurship, in most cases, for instance, it's still playing with conventional money. That means it still plays with built-in scarcity models. So you have people who want to share, but they're going to use an information system called money that concentrates, that go in the hands of the few, or that they have to compete for in order to get the grants or to get some donations or, you know, things like that. And so at some point, you're still playing by the same old game, and the kind of social business that you're going to make comes as a consequence of scarcity. That means you build this most of this social business because the system is like that, but you're still using the kind of old rules of the system. So I'm not condemning this. I'm just trying in my own research, at a very humble, modest way, to see, how can I just, play with different rules at the fundamental level? So that means, I don't want to use money anymore. And I know you guys know a lot about this in your own life and your own choices and what you do. But it's also things about food, of course. Food, I do not want to have in my plate and in my body something that has created violence on people, on sentient beings in the world and so on. Okay, how do I do that? And how do I stay healthy with this? So then I moved to, eating fruits and raw food and what we call live food. And I love this. Also, I don't want to play any institutional role. So today I have no bank account. I have no titles. I'm not the boss of this or the CEO of that or the president of this. No status. That means it provides me entire freedom to, for instance, when I go and speak with some global CEOs and leaders, well, I don't need to be a teacher. I don't need to be a consultant. I don't need to be the CEO of this or that. I just have to be myself. And then I can play completely freely by the, natural laws. And the natural laws is we're, two human beings meeting. And what is our dream? What do we want to accomplish? Why are we here for? And maybe later we can use, institutional leverage or conventional tools like money. But the core alliance that has been created is based on, cosmic laws, something that is vaster than what we know in our current world. I'm trying to stick to that. And of course, it's not easy because I do have a structure of my time. I do evolve in a culture that is still part of me, but I'm trying to step out of what we call the doxa. Doxa, D-O-X-A, is a Greek word that expresses what is the whole belief structure in which we are and which we might be trapped. And language is the most powerful tools that keep us trapped in the doxa. So I hope it speaks a little bit about your question. I'm not sure. You tell me.
No, this is great. I've shared a little bit about your perspective on things with a few contacts that I've come across with because I've been so inspired by that approach. And inevitably, the answer that I receive, which I feel myself as well, is this requires a deeper understanding and an examination of one's own needs. And to me, it just fundamentally leads to that question of the paycheck. How do you personally survive without having a defined paycheck coming in? And I know that you have a son. Your son needs a doctor to be available for him when he gets sick. And how do you provide for that?
Well, that's because I have gold buried in my backyard. That's I didn't tell you that, did you? Oh, you missed something there. Okay. So I still use conventional money, of course, because, the day when I don't use conventional money is either, I am in a local community that lives completely in an autarkic way, or that the global system has evolved enough. I mean, there's enough of a big system so that many people can live like that, but it's not the case yet. And I'm a global traveler, so my case is a little bit different. So, yes, I decided to stop selling things. That means whatever I do, for instance, if I help a big company evolve, and when I say evolve, it's not selling more products, but I say, build a dream for people, work better, improve the quality of life and relationship with the market and the environment and so on. Okay. And their collective intelligence and so on. What I would tell you, for instance, if you are the CEO, first I would check with you, we would check together if our dreams are so that we can partner, we can really have a partnership and do a project together. And then as a CEO, you would very likely ask me, well, hey, Jeff, what do you want? I mean, how much you take for that? And I would tell you, well, nothing. I mean, this is, I'm not selling you anything. I'm doing that because I like it, because we're going to have fun. And that's my motivation. Now, I am like a tree. You know, I'm just trying to provide the best possible fruits. And of course, if you want to take care of the tree, you can. But it's not conditional. You know, it can go also in other directions. But I do want you to be generous. That I want. And so, the, you know, what happens in my life is lots of, you know, people or institutions are giving me something. And sometimes it can come as a conventional money or, you know, a bike or a plane ticket or, you know, things that are necessary. So, for instance, in 3 weeks, I'm going to go to India, for instance, for a month. And people are inviting me there because in their opinion, there is value that I can provide. And I'm so glad that we're building that together. And it's so, so joyful. And today, at the moment where I speak to you, I have about 16 euros in my pocket. That's, I think, about $20 or $22. And that's all my savings. I have nothing else. And I've been living with that for the past, you know, couple of weeks. But, you know, I was traveling and invited here and there and doing my, you know, what I love to do. And that's perfect. So I'm still alive and happy and eating. And as for my little boy who goes in a Steiner school, someone has decided to pay for that and to offer that so that I don't have to worry about it. So you see, there's huge generosity coming to me. I'm so grateful about it. And the more generosity comes to me and the more I can give to the world, I think there's a perfect equation here. And I know you guys are know a lot about it. I don't have to say more about it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you so much. This is wonderful. We do know a lot about it, but for me, it's mostly in theory, and so it's amazing to see someone actually practice it. So what we're going to do now is transition to Q&A, and if guests on the call have any questions, just once again, hit star 6, and you will be put on the queue. I think we already have a caller. I'm not sure. Let me check.
This is Harry from Bay Area, from Fremont. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I think it's a fascinating experience for me just to listen to Jean-Francois. His observational skills are amazing. My question is that since most of us have the being intelligence, but not as good as Jean-Francois, how are we going to understand and practice what he's practicing? So my question is, since different beings have got different level of intelligence and we have been programmed since, you know, time immemorial into thinking in a pyramidal way of power, how are we going to deprogram and to have this escape velocity to overcome the gravitational pull of the society? How are we going to manage that to be at the level of thinking as Jean-Francois has got? That's my question.
I think there might be two tracks to follow on that. The first one is just to be patient. You know, like in any new things, just think aviation, for instance, or flight. You know, you had pioneers. You had people who really needed to get into, you know, the deep questions, how are we going to fly? And they were, you know, trying out all these machines and failing and learning great lessons. And today we just need to, you know, put our butt into a plane. And that's very simple. It just becomes the standard. And so I think it's very okay also to be patient and know that, okay, I may not be, you know, pioneering this path, but I know that some people are doing some of the pioneering work, and there'll be, you know, second wave and third wave, and there's so many ways to be part of that ecosystem. We don't need to be a radical, you know, pioneer in every aspect of our life. So that's one first answer. The second answer is, I think you know it also, every one of you, so well. It refers to just the small steps we can do inside ourselves. And what I mean by that is I don't think we need like to have like a great view or a great, you know, masterful understanding of the world. We can just train ourselves to trust our joy, what I call the bliscipline. You know, the bliscipline is just, you know, leave aside any kind of morals or I should do this or that thing is good and helping, you know, the other or is a good action or all these things. Just check what you feel attracted to for the next step. It might be the next hour. And it's very challenging for the mind because the mind will say, hey, you're not going to work. You're not going to get your paycheck. Or, hey, this thing is so silly. You know, you're completely selfish if you do that. You're not thinking about the other anymore. You're not doing your duty or your moral duty and things like that. But when you start to train yourself, it's really like if you're in the labyrinth, you know, following a thread and one step after the other, this is going to lead you out of the dark. But first you have to trust one step after the other without having any understanding of where this is taking you. And so I think and that kind of thing does not require that we have, you know, some kind of mental intelligence or some kind of culture or specific knowledge. I think every one of us is completely equal there, has the same range of possibilities. Just trust your being. Go, you know, check inside yourself what you love to do, and it might be completely immoral. It might be completely out of your, you know, your environment. Trust that this is the right thing. And you don't see what it's building right now. It might even create, you know, ripples and anger around you, but go there. Because this is going to lead you exactly where you need to be. And there's no mental plan there. There's no need for very complex practice. I don't know if it speaks to your question.
No, thank you so much. I think it's very, very enlightening. And I know it's a long path, but you told me that the first step is take a baby step of trust, and then you build upon that. If that's what you're saying, then obviously it may take you a lifetime, but somebody has to start with a baby step first to go to follow the path.
Thank you.
Yes, and really listen to your joy. You know, even the Buddha said, you know, one of the things we want to leave is duty, the sense of duty. Leave it aside. Just go in the being, and consequently, you'll do the greatest. You will give the greatest service to the world just by being who you are. That will lead you to the best place in the world.
Hi, Anne. Go ahead.
Yes, I didn't catch the website where the discussion of 2B is. I found that fascinating. You said you use it a lot, and I think you've articulated many things extremely well. But could you tell me where I could find or the website for this discussion about 2B in the English language?
Sure. First, you can just start with Wikipedia, and you type E prime, the letter E prime. It stands for English prime. So it's a way to say, okay, I don't speak conventional English anymore. I will speak a prime version of or the next version of English. So you go to Wikipedia E prime, and you will find it, and then you'll have, you know, many links that you can follow. Of course, you can Google E-Prime as well, and I'll be happy to send Birju a few links that I found very useful for that.
Hi, thank you so much.
I'm happy to send it out to everyone, but I've already sent it to you, Anne.
Oh, well, thank you. You're very kind.
Wonderful. Thank you, Birju. You're very efficient.
Hi, this is Robin.
Hi, Robin.
So I'm already doing some of what you're talking about. I'm actually a little nervous talking to you. I normally don't talk on your call. For example, I have a website that I launched called Your Holiday Mom, which is 40 moms sending messages of love, willing to be a stand-in holiday mom for LGBTQ kids, transgender people. Just basically saying, if you're having a rough holiday, you know, here's my message to you. And I put it up, you know, there's no profit motive. There's no anything. It's a joy to work with everybody to put it together. It's a lot of work, but it's a lot of fun. So I feel like I'm doing that. But I also know that I've done quite a lot of things like this on a small scale, and I feel like I'm moving even more towards that. The conventional wisdom would be probably to, for the work that I do that is paid, and I work for myself, but to raise prices and work with fewer people so that I can give more, that's probably the most conventional wisdom I've come across so far to do this. But I'm wondering if in all of your experience you might have some other lines of thought that I might go down to explore besides that.
I guess most of us, as a first step when we want to start, I mean, when we go more and more into our being, then we start to split in two. Like there's, you know, something for the paycheck, and it might be an interesting thing, but it does not fully fulfill the being. And then there's another part of our life where we really love what we do, you know, through generosity, art, whatever is the expression of our being. And we kind of, you know, we're split in two. And I think it really reflects inside a structure when we're split in two. You know, I would say, let me make it a very simple picture, you know, the paycheck on one side and the other side, the being. This being split in two reflects very much what is outside in the world as well, a transition. Transition means we have one foot in the old world and one foot in the other world. Now, if you really want to continue, move forward, I really invite you to decide that what you think is not your radical joy, you don't do it. And it does trigger us because, I mean, it can hit hard in, you know, in our feelings, because we say, okay, well, if I don't do it, then I'm going to die. Or even worse, my kids are not going to eat. You know, for ourselves, we can make this kind of choices. But when it comes to, you know, kids and people we love, that's much much bigger challenge. Yet, I do invite you to go there and decide that what is not you, you never, ever do it again. What is you, you do it all the time. And the mental is challenged all the time because it says, I'm not going to pay for my rent, people are going to be mad at me, and so on and so on. But what the mental cannot see is that it completely changes our vibrations. It completely changes the way we speak with people. So, for instance, when we fully enter in our dream, when we talk about our dream, then we attract people who want to support that. We attract generosity, and we attract and create possibilities that we have never thought of before because we were still dedicating too much energy in the old scarcity model or the survival model. And here, let me be clear, we're not about surviving. We're here about living, you know, fully, just shining. But it does require this this choice, this jump, this leap of deciding that we are not going to compromise anymore in doing anything that is not the expression of our being. Now, of course, it's a tough question because in most cases, we don't really know what our being is. You know, it doesn't come like a full picture in the first place. We learn about the nature of our being through different experiences and incremental experiences, you know, just another way to say it, you know, putting ourselves a little more into some deep shit situations where our being kind of reveals itself to ourselves. Yet, I do think there's a one-time decision that we can always make when we say inside, okay, now that's it. I will always do or try to do as far as my understanding goes, try to do something that is the radical expression of my being. And if something says, oh, you should do this just to survive, but this is not your being, you don't do it. And you go with the consequences. And it might be dying, or it might be, you know, starvation or anything. You have to accept those consequences, but this is where you really get into your freedom and your power. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. I'm 90% with doing all that already. So I do what is my joy. I just... it was just, but you gave me what I needed out of that. Thank you so much.
First, I want to say thank you to everybody for being here. This has been a fabulous hour to way to start my day. Harry and Anne and Robin stole all my questions, and you answered them beautifully. I'd like to touch base with Robin about your website. As a parent of a gay youth, I can recommend you, and you brought shivers to me with your website. I'd like to have that again, if I could, so I could do some more research and maybe become one of those mothers. Jean, I'd like to, I don't know if I have a question, but I'd like to point out, see if you agree that I'm getting the idea of the collective consciousness properly. I read a story on karma, or watched a story on Karma Tube the other day, and Chimamanda was the lady's name, and she was from Nigeria, and she was telling a story about single storyism. And when you touch base on Thingify, to me, that was a perfect example of the collective consciousness working from two totally separate ends of the planet. Would you agree? And thank you for your time and immense gratitude for you being here.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understand your question. You mean you believe it's an example of the collective consciousness? You mean the thingification, or what this lady thinks or she said? I'm from Nigeria. That's where I'm not sure about the question.
I think they are the exact, what I'm thinking is that they are the exact, it's like when somebody can have an idea here, say in Canada, and over in Australia at the exact same time.
Oh, okay, now I understand. Now, thank you. Okay, thank you for helping me understand. So yes, I have, and that's one of the fields of collective intelligence, and we can really observe that objectively. That when you have a thought or an aha moment or a breakthrough, it is happening not just inside you. I think we have now enough evidence that intelligence and consciousness is a transcendent thing. That means when the phenomenon happens inside you, it's just like a radio broadcast, you know. It's not because the radio device is speaking that the intelligence comes from inside the radio device. It goes through the radio device. And now different radio devices may be tuned into different broadcasts and say different things. But fundamentally, everything seems completely transcendent and at the same time imminent. That means, yes, you are the person speaking. Yes, your being is completely taking responsibility for connecting or tuning into different vibrations or different broadcasts or different flows of evolution. So it's not one or the other. It's both. We are imminent because we are creators. We are artists. We create reality. We make it. And at the same time, we play with waves, and these waves are non-local. That means, you know, a thought is here and the thought is there at the same time. I see that operating all the time. And I think the holomidal collective intelligence, to connect to earlier questions about these new forms of collective intelligence, holomidal collective intelligence has created a technology, or is using a technology called the internet, and the internet is a space for serendipity. Space for serendipity means that this space really facilitates this experience that you're making, because you can see at play, you know, just check that. When you have a thought or an aha moment or a breakthrough, Google it or share it with, you know, Twitter, and then you will see how many people are just on the same page at the same time. You can observe that all the time. That's so interesting now to see that our species is able to connect, and that means to cluster or to create groups of people who are, you know, on the fly, able to operate on that same thought at the same time. It did not exist 15 years ago. It's just starting to exist now, and that's such a quantum leap in our species, so that we can gather through synchronistic thoughts and synchronistic processes. Does that speak to your thought?
It truly does. Thank you very much.
Hi, this is Ashish from New Jersey. When you mentioned the example of a five-year-old and the distinction between doing and being, I found it very fascinating because I have a five-year-old and I could relate to your example very clearly. I had a question on the lines of being versus doing. It seems a lot of the things that you mentioned in terms of technology innovations like Twitter or, you know, Google, it seems that those have been created through kind of the more doing states, where there's I don't know what the term was you used, where it's more pyramid type, hierarchical state of being, where people are not really being, but it's very conventional sort of thinking. But a lot of these innovations have come from that space. And to juxtapose that against the being state, you know, which is where you are and where, you know, you're seeing people maybe evolve to, do you see the dance between doing and being as the way of the universe, or do you see evolution are as evolving, you know, towards completely into the state of being?
I see what we call reality. That means something we would name, you know, as the external world. And in the external world, then we operate through doing. I see that external world as just a mirror of the internal world, where we operate as being through stillness. It's just, you know, two mirrors, and consciousness needs a mirror to see itself. So you see yourself when you operate, you do something in the world. This is going to reveal something about your being. Your being is going to see itself and grow and expand through your actions. And so this is, I really see our whole reality as just a mirroring effect. And interestingly, also through evolution, you can see that as some kind of, you know, back and forth dance between being and doing. And when I say evolution, is evolution of our life first, because the more, you know, our being expands and has, you know, inner vastness, and then the more we can do. It really provides much more capacity for doing. And the more we can do, then the more we offer possibilities for our being to see itself and to understand some limitations, because we don't do well, or we fail, or we don't achieve, you know, things fully. And then we learn, oh, okay, this is because my being has not yet understood such and such thing. And then you can see it really shed lights inside yourself. And also, you were naming, you know, technologies like Google and so on. I find it very fascinating to see the old, you know, pyramidal collective intelligence provide fundamental bricks for the next form. And we also see how there is, you know, a creation in the doing, which is providing tools that the being can use. And we have had these cycles in, you know, in the past. For instance, think of writing. Writing came because people wanted to do some accounting and write some contracts. The first forms of writing that we have are about accounting and building, you know, business contracts in the most case. But it's been used for writing poetry and the most, you know, beautiful things, and the worst as well. So it's just to show how, you know, being and doing can really dance together. And today we can use the internet the same way. I personally try to use the internet as a space for synchronicity or a space for serendipity, so that my being can really operate much more easily than if there was no internet. And I find that experience quite fascinating. Does that speak to your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much.
Well, my pleasure.
Thank you. I had a couple of questions, and I also wanted to check with you if you are able to stay a couple of minutes after 10:30, because it looks like there are two more callers. And I'm not sure if you have other engagements after this, and if you can stay for 5 minutes or so.
I'm totally fine and absolutely happy to be with you. It's such a great honor to be there. So please go on. No problem.
Thank you so much. But what I'm going to do is we are going to close the call like we do usually, and then we will go over so that people who want to leave can leave. So what I wanted to check with you, John, this has been a fascinating conversation. What I want to know is if people want to engage with your work more deeply, like where can we go, what can we do, and also how we can support you as a community.
Thank you for asking this question. Well, first of the last part, to support me, there are so many ways through generosity. I you know, you can if you want to know more, I'm happy to send you you know, a link or an email saying, you know, what are very specific things that I either need personally or that as a community we need. And it goes from, you know, very basic things like food up to, you know, helping build websites, you know, or transportation or, you know, things like that. So very, very precise things. So that's for the support. And in order to co-create and collaborate and co-conspire about the world we want to create, there are also many ways. And, you know, we can organize, if you want, someday, 1 week, you know, retreat or what I call boot camp, where we can really train together and explore the future. I really value a lot training, you know, because before we play in the real field, training and having games and learning is a very powerful thing. There are also lots of fields that we do in the research arena, you know, research and development on what we call free currencies. That means the software part, and where there's lots and lots of things to do. And there's lots of fields of research in ontology and in social code, in food, in, you know, many, many areas where research and development can be useful and contribution can be useful. So I guess it's more like a one-to-one conversation also, because whatever you may want to do has to connect to your own joy. We're really careful about not having people who do things because of duty, but because of joy, because you really, really like it. And that's not always that obvious. So I think there's a journey there to explore together and to have some kind of mutual support on that.
Thank you so much. So maybe you can send me some links, like Birju and me, and we will send them out to everyone who was on the call and also maybe to the broader community, because we'll be posting your audio, and also Bill will be writing a blog about this. So we will include all that information so that it is more people have access to it.
Okay.
Thank you so much. So what we are going to do next is Birju will close the call, and after that we will do a minute of silence expressing gratitude for all the wonderful things that made this call happen today. And then I will unmute everyone, and we can collectively say thank you to John at a count of three. And after that, we will just go over for 5 minutes. I do know there are two more callers who had a couple of questions, but people who want to leave can just express their gratitude, and then they are free to leave. And the people who want to stay can stay after 10:30. So I'm going to hand it over to Birju again.
Thank you, Kanchan. And I just want to share my own gratitude to JF for taking the time out to do this. I don't know how much I've shared with the rest of the group, but I consider JF to be quite an inspiration in my own life, although much like he said, baby steps is the name of the game as far as I'm concerned. But, you know, when I think about the kind of work that you're doing, Jean-Francois, you know, you're putting on these kinds of conferences, but for you to take out, you know, this significant amount of time to speak with a group of folks that are trying to be authentic. Now, I personally feel deeply grateful that you would take that time out, seeing the authenticity of the folks that are behind this community. And so thank you.
I think Prakash had a question.
Thank you, Kanchan. You can hear me okay, right?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. JF, thank you so much. Birju, it was beautiful. Just when I thought I had a question, Ashish asked that question. Thank you, Ashish. Now I had to think of another quick one. I also share the same feeling. I do not want to go away, and I want to ask this question out of joy. JF, so this question is around your wealth of wealth. I was curious to know any, you know, emerging experiences after you took that vow, and any experiences that pushed you to your edge around this. Thank you so much.
The vow of wealth, when it came, was really like being struck by lightning. You know, it just came in a second. I mean, it took me a few hours to write it down in a good way, as you know, English is not my native language, so to write it in a proper way. But as an emotion, as an energy, it just came so suddenly, as you know, just crossing a threshold. And at the moment when it came in my being, it's like something has decided inside the being, and I could feel, and I was with my beloved partner, Yarananda, at the time. She was really witnessing this process, and we could even both sense right at the moment that lots of things were going to be impacted in the very moment. I mean, just like a process, you know, that just begins, and we knew that weeks after, or I mean, days after, weeks after, years after, it would just create something. It was really quite a beautiful experience to witness how, you know, the being, something changes in the being, and you can already feel all the ripples that it is going to create in the world without trying to do any action. You know, I was not even projecting, you know, things that I would do. I was just sensing, wow, this is just going to change something. I don't know how, but I can feel it right now. So that was one of the remarkable experiences of the vow of wealth. Now, for the challenge, I think the biggest challenge that I've had, and I still have, even no later than yesterday, is with my family. Because, you know, there's so much transgenerational stuff that we carry on, you know, karmic stuff that we carry on from one generation to another. And, for instance, you know, there's some stuff that I still have, that I still possess, not a lot, but that come from my family, you know, like some pieces of furniture that belonged to my great-great-grandparents, you know, or a picture of my great-grandfather with my grandmother, you know, and that picture has a lot of beautiful value from a photograph perspective. It's an amazing picture, things like that. So they don't have like much of a financial value, but they belong to a family, and they've been given to me by my own parents. But it comes with strings attached, like you have it, you got to earn it, and you got to transmit that, and you got to comply to a certain way or a certain lifestyle. It comes with lots of things. And no later than yesterday, you know, these things are in a container. And I've been traveling and haven't been paying for this container. Not that I don't want to pay. It's just that I've been, you know, out of that. And this is a big company, so it's not they're dying because they're not paid. They are going to be paid, but I just, you know, jumped a few months and I didn't even think about it. Now there's this guy who sends this email yesterday, and he says, well, we've destroyed all your container because you didn't pay. And he was, you know, it was a very violent and aggressive email just before I was giving my TED conference, and I could see how hit I was by that. Not because I was losing something, because, you know, I'm living without it. It's been in a container for like a couple of years now, or 3 years. So I can totally survive without it. It's not that I feel any need for that. And it can disappear. It's okay. But I was really observing myself, how am I going to say that to my parents? Or I could see, you know, the sense of guilt, like I should have paid this guy, or I'm attracting this, you know, this thing unto me. I could really see also how vulnerable I could still be on these things, and I could witness all the things coming in my mind, like I should have been this or that. And so I still feel very vulnerable with that. And it's okay. You know, I don't want to be Iron Man at all. It's not the goal. But I can see that it's quite a very sensitive, string there, very sensitive spot there. And I still want to learn from that. It was a gift, actually, of course. So I could really see how I operate there. Does that answer your question?
Oh, very beautifully, yeah. I'm in awe of your observational skills, as Jerry said. So beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you so much. We have one more person who I see the Skype name. It's Transformational Global Leadership.
Yes, this is Michelle Ehlers.
Hi, Michelle. Go ahead.
Hi. This is the first time I'm Skyping in. Hello, Jean-Francois.
Wow, what a surprise to find you here. What a beautiful surprise.
Absolutely. And this is the first time I'm Skyping into this call. I've been sitting on many of them for a long time. And for the past few weeks, I have not made it. And it was a surprise to me this morning when I checked to see who was there that it was you. And it's wonderful that this is the first call that I'm Skyping in because it relates to my question. First of all, I just want to send incredible amounts of love. I've been feeling so connected with you recently and thinking a lot about you, and it's so great to be able to talk to you again. The question that I have is I've been actually leaving behind a lot of the technology for the past couple of years to really do some inner work. And I'm just at the point where I'm reconnecting with technology and reconnecting with the world through technology. But I'd love your input on this. One of the reasons that I've sort of stayed away from technology and been on that edge is the sense to me that, you know, the Twittering and the Facebook and all of this is so dependent on the filter of language, and so much of the richness that I find in the connection and the collective intelligence is non-language and non, it feels to me like it's non-connective through the language realm. I've been exploring more and more connecting through non-language, non-physical connections, not like I feel like I have a lot of facility with it, but more in the realm of telepathy or in a field rather than through technology. And I understand the power of technology completely since I'm so connected globally, but also aware of the limitations. Do you have any thoughts or would you speak to that?
Thank you, Michelle, for this this question. I think it's a very powerful question. And it is one of the core questions we explore in the realm of collective intelligence, because yes, I totally agree with you. Everything is not just about language, and when we use all these tools, we are using conventional words. We're, you know, using our keyboards and using words, and it mostly activates our mental. And so I think we do have to invent the responses here. This is where we become creators of worlds. And maybe I can share a few hints.
Sunny!
Hey, what did I hear? What was it?
This is what happens when you unmute everyone.
Okay.
This is the collective consciousness.
Wonderful. So that was joy there, so it was wonderful. So, yeah, a few things. First, when I am in front of a computer, I try not to lose myself. That means disconnect the sense of my body. And what I do then, in most cases, I try to do sessions that are no more than 50 minutes when I work on the computer, and then spend 10 minutes, you know, moving my body or do something else that's not in the screen. That means I reconnect to myself. And then, you know, the next session when I'm going to write this email, I will be connected to myself and I will share different things. My words will be different and my emotions and everything will be different. And that can be really sensed into the way that email or Skype or whatever conventional tool, Twitter and so on, is used. Even my choices, you know, what I'll decide to do and not to do, I can, when I have this 10 minutes break, I don't get, you know, swamped into just, you know, the computer or the online world unconsciously. I can really decide what I am going to do and not to do. That's one thing. The other thing is I do stick to a practice of a minimum of 1, if not 2 hours of intensive body training every day. That means I really take it as a very fundamental thing to keep in the joy of being in my body and then bring this body into the online world. I think that's also a very important thing. Three, we've been doing it here. You know, we've been bringing the being and silence in our conference call. And I think this is just the beginning of it because we're inventing new social codes, but also technologies are evolving. You know, we have things like Skype and which are more, I would say, more advanced technologies. Unfortunately, it's still for just a few people, not many people. So we still use Bridgeline when we're more people. But Skype and other visual technologies where we can see each other, then we can bring the body and the emotions and the physical in a much more advanced way that we still don't have with, you know, Twitter or conventional email and things like that. So I also think that we want to be patient because technologies are evolving. And when you look at the world of games, you know, all these consoles, these games that we can play with, you know, the Wii and all these things, the body is becoming more and more part of that. And more this is going to be connected. So it's very likely that in the future we will have some biofeedback. Maybe, you know, you will sense me, I will sense you, some moves or gesture that I can do. You may even sense it on your skin. And I really think this is going to evolve. And I encourage each of us who are pioneering these questions to start to invent new social codes and new behaviors so that we don't separate the body, the physical, the emotions, and the online world. We want to really invest all these parts of the being in the online world, and we want to invent that because this is not going to happen otherwise. I don't know what you think about that.
That's great. Do you have anything specific to say about it? One of the things for me is I play in languages and different languages. There's so different worlds in the different languages. When I'm in Chinese, it's a very different world than in English. And I'm challenged with, as I'm, you know, in my world is, my life is given to bringing humanity together into that global consciousness. And when we're working through the language, it feels like there's such a break between Chinese speakers and English speakers or French speakers. You know, the world is so different. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. And at the same time, I think we witness, and our generation is going to witness a kind of meta language. And the meta language is the language of wealth. That means, you know, when I say thank you to someone or when I express gratitude, it doesn't really matter which language I use. I can even use gesture or facial expressions. And soon enough, we will have tools to express those things through online language, through icons, through colors, through, you know, flowers, virtual objects, you know, things like that. And I think there's a new language of wealth, what we call in our jargon, the language of flows to express, you know, the multi dimensions of wealth. And this is really coming up. This is really coming soon. So I think there are also interesting and promising technologies and languages showing up, which does not, they don't take away anything also from the past as well.
Got it. Thank you so much. I would love to connect with you further personally, and I'd like to speak to you about the idea of having you come to Santa Fe, New Mexico, if you're interested, which is where I am now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Done deal.
Okay.
Let's start.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.